Hello and welcome to the Sabbatarianism podcast. My name is Justin Hoos. I am joined today by with my good friend Paul Silty. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Justin. Good to hear from you.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Paul. We've done a couple of podcasts now, and we're going to start on our third one here today, kind of picking up where we left off. So that you know, our conversations kind of intertwine so much that I've decided to go ahead and just consider this one podcast with three parts, and I named it From the City Back to Eden, because it seems like our conversations about going back to Eden and life in the city have just intertwined so much that I thought that would probably be a better way to do it.
Yeah, okay, that sounds like a good plan, and there's so much to talk about on this subject. It's almost endless, and we certainly can fill in many areas here as we go along.
Yes, we could. Well, let me do a little housekeeping here real quick. We want to encourage all listeners to first and foremost read the Bible for yourself. That is the beginning of knowledge of God, and it is the most important part. Sermons and podcasts and other things can wait until after you've read the Bible. So please start there. And if you are new to the podcast, please start in the beginning. Work forward, at least starting with episode 3, and work back to this position or wherever you would like. But a lot of big topics are covered in the beginning of the podcast, and we encourage you to start there. All right, housekeeping done. Paul, when we left off, on my notes here from your paper, we left off at the part of the camp. And this is where you kind of start, comparing or contrasting, or not really contrasting, just showing how the Bible kind of uses the camp and what that's all about. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
Yes, I think so. The camp can be likened to the city in many respects.
Right.
Certainly in Scripture it can be. Camp was a temporary dwelling place, but it was like a city in that the Israelites and the other nations would construct their tents in a small area for protection, for one thing, but also just for the fellowship and enjoyment they had for one another. And that's how I look upon it. The camp and the city are very much the same.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Paul, even before you wrote that paper and before I heard the great Jim Rector, his sermon on Outside the Camp, we had likened the fellowship and the gathering at the Fall Festival, at the Feast of Tabernacles, to the camp, especially there in Oklahoma where we have feasted together. We considered it kind of a camp where it was almost like a small village that we would create once a year, and it was just a wonderful experience. And as you say here, it's temporary dwellings, yet it is a place of safety and a place of rest and warmth and fellowship and enjoyment. And that's how you described the camp in your paper. And as I was reading that, it just really made me think of the feast and how I always felt about the feast and still do.
Yes, and I don't mean to imply that it's evil to have a camp at the feast.
Right. Yeah.
That's not the idea. But that kind of a camp, I would say, is more like the very city of God, the
yes.
New Jerusalem, because that, of course, is a city, but it's not on the same level as the cities in this world. You have a city that's ordered by God himself in the New Jerusalem, and at the feasts, that's very much like that. We have a city of God's people ordered around his great plan and his structure, and the enjoyment there and the fellowship and the rest and the safety are not one of captivity like in modern day cities, but it's one of actually liberation, and it's one of joy and peace unending.
Yes, exactly. And I guess it all depends on who the leader or the ruler of the camp is. And when we gather for the feast, it's God is the ruler, and it's the way it's supposed to be. Whereas with the city, unfortunately, as of right now, until Messiah comes back, the ruler of most cities or all cities is Satan.
That's correct. And unfortunately, even modern day Jerusalem is part of that city complex over the face of the earth. Of course, that will be changed when the city of God is there in the New Jerusalem, and Jesus Christ is set up as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But for now, we have cities all across the face of the earth, unfortunately, and they're not the most enjoyable and pleasant and good places to live.
Yes, sir. And we'll come back to the thought on Jerusalem. I've got that in my notes, and I'm glad you brought that up. I think that needs to be discussed, and we'll get to that later. But I have a quote here from your paper concerning camps, and the quote is, quote, "Yet to be in the camp comes with a price. A person might need to give up some freedoms and personal rights to remain there. Certain moral principles may need to be compromised to remain a part of the camp. Go along to get along." That's a great quote. And I think, you know, all of our readers should have read the Bible, as I said earlier. And I think we see that in the Bible where compromises are made. And I think back to the children of Israel when God asked them to come outside of the Egyptian camp and come to him and be a camp with him, just as we're kind of juxtapositioning the feast camp versus the city, God wanted to invite them to his camp where there would be peace and equity and justice and liberty, whereas they had been in Egypt. And unfortunately, you read through Exodus that they complained and wanted to go back to the camp of Egypt because it felt more safe to them, and their bellies were full and they had water to drink and so on and so forth.
Yes. Well, certainly in Egypt, they were, well, actually in Goshen, where the Israelites were living, they had a fairly pastoral existence. They did build cities for the Egyptians, but they themselves didn't inhabit them. And when they came out of Egypt, they came out as, of course, a great army, maybe 4 million or even more. And they did live in, you might say, well, they lived in camps, you know, when they were exiting after they left the Red Sea, moving towards Mount Sinai. But the camp is fine as long as everyone is following the precepts of the Eternal. Unfortunately, that is not how the Israelites lived as they stayed in their camp and were complaining about the water being bitter or there being no water and things were hard and it was tough. Treading through that desert land on the way to Mount Sinai. So there was a price to pay because of human nature in the camp. And I think that's the big issue. You might say that if we had cities that where people were really living according to God's precepts, we wouldn't have the problems we have today. But we know that human nature is inhabiting every single person on this earth, and cities are the way they are because of that.
I would also offer that Abraham was almost a nomad. You know, he lived in temporary dwelling. He lived in tents, but he had God as his king, and he followed God. And it doesn't say it specifically in the Bible, but I'm guessing that Abraham made sure that everyone inside of his camp, his kingdom, was obeying the laws of God and following God. In fact, we do see that or read that Abraham, God told him that everyone needed to be, all the men needed to be circumcised, and he did it that day. And so it can be done if you will allow God to be the leader of your camp.
Right. And I was not implying when I was speaking about the city that it's the best place for mankind to live, even if people were to obey, you know, the laws of God and to live according to his precepts, because man was designed to live in Eden, where there was plenty of room, where there were just the beautiful surroundings, food all around, no shortages, the climate was beautiful. That's where man was intended to live. And certainly that's the way it was in the Garden of Eden, and that's the way we look forward to it being in the next age.
Yeah, in the paper you move on to discuss outside the camp. And for those that are unaware, you and I listened to a great sermon by Jim Rector, who has now passed away. But we listened to it at the feast, and that kind of spurred your thoughts on this for writing this paper. And I will link to that sermon. I don't know his family and wouldn't feel comfortable posting that sermon myself, but I will link to where you can go listen to it on their website. It's an excellent sermon. But you have a quote here about outside the camp, and it's, quote, "Our Heavenly Father is outside the camp and calling all his people to leave the camp. Inside the camp, you are provided your every physical need by the system established there. You are a slave. You are within the system, and you're likely not even aware that you are enslaved," end quote. So I think that really speaks to what we've been talking about here with the city.
Absolutely. And I would think that most people that live in cities today, and in the United States, that's, you know, 83-85% of the people in this country, they really do not understand, you might say, that they're living in enslaved conditions inside that city camp. So it's a major issue that people need to be aware of, open their minds to, and certainly realize that this is not the way God intended people to live.
Yeah, the thing about it is, I think each person, each man needs to have his own kingdom with God as the ruler, the leader of that kingdom within his own home, regardless of where that is, whether that's inside a city or out in the country or wherever that may be. That's the important part. But I think what you're saying is that that would be true, but the best place to accomplish that and do that and to live as God intended would be somewhere outside of a city, more in the country.
Right. And I'm not meaning to demean anyone who lives in the city, because most people do.
Yeah.
But, you know, we ought to strive for perfection. I think all of us have that within us. We want to do the very best we can, be in the best circumstances that we possibly can be in. And that would be in the circumstance that God designed for mankind. And if we have the ability to get into that environment, then we should.
Yeah, and like we were saying, talking about just a little while ago, is Israel was invited outside of the camp, and all they wanted was to go back to the camp of Egypt. They didn't like being outside of that camp once they were out. It's almost as if they had Stockholm syndrome. They almost didn't realize they were slaves, even though they were made to work hard, making bricks and all that. But as for Mount Sinai, here in your paper, you have a quote of, "And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain." That's from Exodus 19 and verse 17. And I think your implication here is, in order to meet God, to go and meet with God, they had to go outside the camp. He was not going to meet them inside the camp.
Yes, that just shows, again, how God wants to meet us. And he wants us to meet him in the environment that he designed for mankind, I believe. Certainly the whole mass of those hundreds of thousands of people that met at the foot of Mount Sinai had been living, you know, in a camp, their tents were close together. He wanted to bring them out of that environment and to at least be out of the city, out of the camp, in order to meet him. So that, to me, means an awful lot. He wants us to be in the environment with plenty of place for meditation, plenty of places to be around the creation, and just to have a very close relationship with him in the environment he has designed.
Yeah, to develop a deep, close, personal relationship with God, I think it's best done in solitude, when you're alone with him, when you have his word and he can work with you, and you don't have so many of the outside influences from others and from those who are being led by the evil one.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up the topic of the evil one, because he is the designer of cities as we know them. And it's very important that we understand that. He's the one that wants to capture the attention and the allegiance of everyone here on this earth. And it's much, much easier to do that within the confines of a city and with all the character of it. And of course, my paper, my book, goes into that issue in great detail.
Yeah, I had an experience, Paul. I moved to Seattle. It's been many years ago now, but as you know, I'm a Kansas boy, grew up in Kansas, and it's I lived in Wichita, which is a decent sized city, but I'll tell you, when I moved to Seattle, it was a completely different thing, and I felt like I could see more clearly the evil around me. And it wasn't expressed in outright evil. The way I saw it expressed, in my opinion, was just a lack of hospitality, and people didn't hold doors open for each other. And when I would hold the door open, which is standard in Kansas, people would look at me like I was crazy, and people didn't talk to their neighbors, and I would wave to the neighbor, and they were almost taken aback by that. And I remember being outside one day on the roof, and I could see the neighbor there, and I just said, "Hi." And again, they were just kind of taken aback, like, "How dare you?" And that's where I saw the evil of it. And it's not that I think those people were evil. It's just the influence of evil had done that to them. And then a few years later, I moved back to Kansas, and I felt like I could see the same type of thing when I looked at how people lived inside of Wichita or Kansas City or one of the other big cities versus how the people were that were rural living out in the country. There was, when I lived out in the country, my neighbors and I waved at each other every day. You know, I could just see it creeping out from the city. And it's almost like a virus or a disease that's spreading, and it's coming out of the cities.
Yes, I commiserate with you entirely about that situation, with the difference between the rural areas that you grew up in and the cities, especially the bigger cities. I grew up in southwestern Minnesota, and we likewise, on the farms, you know, knew all of our neighbors, and we'd always wave to our neighbors. In fact, if our neighbors had a problem, we'd all chip in and help the person. Like if somebody got injured during harvest season, you'd find the neighbors chipping in to contribute their time and machinery to, say, harvest a corn crop or bale alfalfa or something, in order to help that person. But in a city environment, it's very different. People, as I go into in the book, people have to build in defense mechanisms with such cramped quarters, with so many people. They can't possibly show kindness and friendliness, you know, to those around them, or they, you know, just give them really a lot of problems. If you can imagine what it must have been like If you can remember the movie series Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
I remember the one scene where he was walking down the street. I think it was New York. And he was just, you know, as he was used to doing back in Australia, he was waving to pedestrians coming by him there in the sidewalk. And they were looking at him as if he was, you know, outright crazy. So it's quite a difference in being brought up in an environment where there's plenty of room, where there are, you know, your neighbors, you don't have to fear them if they might be criminals, or if they are, you know that they are. So it's quite a difference between the city and the countryside environments.
It certainly is. I'll tell you, we moved to East Texas, and there's still that rural type living here, and I just really like it. Everyone here holds doors open for each other. Everyone says thank you. Everyone waves. I mean, it's still here. I see it creeping out of here too, but it sure is nice to be back in that environment. It still exists in Kansas, but it's fleeing from the cities. I wanted to talk about something else from your paper, The City, which is becoming a book. And by the way, if you would like to check out Paul's work or read some of his articles on his website is churchesathome.org. But Paul, you have a quote here about 501c3s, and I found this fascinating. And it's a bit lengthy, but I'd like to read through these, if you don't mind, and maybe talk about them as we go here. So, some of this, the requirements of a 501c3 absolutely floored me. I didn't know all of this. But first, you have to have a recognized creed and IRS-approved worship. Is that right, Paul?
That's according to the source that I got that information from. Yes, indeed. That and many other requirements are supposedly from the IRS, and I assume that that is correct.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and jump through these as quick as I can here, but this is unbelievable. So number two is have a definite and distinct ecclesiastical or hierarchical government within your organization. Have ordained ministers. Have ministers in state-accredited colleges. Be neutral on political issues. Be engaged in activities furthering exclusively public purposes. Open its services to the public. Have a pastor answer to the IRS as to the daily activities of the church. Let the IRS be privy to all financial transactions, including source, donors, and expenditures. Have books and records available to the IRS at all times. Use only IRS-approved methods of fundraising. Advocate and promote racial integration, not engage in political activities opposing pornography. Wow. Not support legislation saying that children belong to parents, not the state. Not support any legislation that opposes lotteries or gambling activities. Not advocate support of the U.S. or state constitutions as the supreme law of the land. Not actively participate in opposing the public school system. Not publicly declare that the church is to obey God rather than the government. I'll tell you, when I read that, Paul, that really blew me back. I've had it in my mind that I don't think being a 501c3 is the way to go. I never could really put my finger on it. I just thought, why would we need to do that? You can still make a charitable donation to an organization, even if they are not a 501c3, and it is still deductible from your income. So I just don't know why we would need 501c3s, but this just doesn't sound healthy to me.
No, and it certainly isn't healthy. Those are all points according to the source that I have, and I think they are accurate. But I don't think the IRS is real stringent in enforcing all of these points. That's been my experience in just looking at some of the 501c3 registered organizations. I believe the state of Virginia does not require that, or they may not even allow that to happen. So you certainly don't have to be registered as a 501c3 to operate. But that is the way most of them are organized. And it's, of course, that's a satanic organization. I go into that also in one of my other books called Understanding God's Government. That's something that discusses these issues at length. So we have a need to examine carefully, you know, what we're involved in this world, and not get entangled with the world in any way.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of research on what's called private membership associations or private membership organizations. And there is a website out there where the guy has pledged that he would help any church file under this. It's called the PMAteam.club. But I don't know if you remember many years ago when I was a kid, that at least in Kansas, maybe it wasn't all over the country, but in order to drink alcohol in restaurants, the restaurant had to be private. And so you had to join a club. You'd have to pay, I don't know, $10 a year to be a member of their organization, and then you could come there and you could drink. Now, not this isn't about drinking, but there also used to be private membership organizations that were kind of like co-ops, to where people could sell their goods in the private. And I think personally that our community, the Sabbatarian community, needs to move in this direction, to where our organizations or our gatherings need to be organized as private and outside of the public, outside of government. And I believe, based on my research, that this is the way to go, is private membership organization or associations, to where you pay a small nominal fee every year, and then you have an organization that is declared private, and you can do whatever you wish, however you wish, in a private organization.
Well, that sounds like a great idea, and I'd be all for that. I'm not very familiar, as you are, with them, but that sounds like a real good road to travel.
Yeah, and then I have here in my notes another kind of ominous part of your paper, and that is the smart city. What is a smart city based on your research, Paul?
Well, smart city is a city organized around basically pretty much total control of your life. And sometimes they're called 15-minute cities. They're about the same definition, whereby you are monitored by various devices, you know, in the streets and in the city itself, where you can basically have access to anything you need, your food, your entertainment, every aspect of your living, by either walking or bicycling within 15 minutes of where you live. So essentially, you're captive within that small area. I'm not sure how many miles that might be wide. It probably would be less than a mile for a smart city, a diameter. I'm not certain about that distance, but the point is, they're trying to bring you into basically captivity within a certain area so that you can be controlled. And it's, of course, goes against the opposite nature of mankind, which desires liberty. But there's a big push to really develop these. Sao Paulo, Brazil, is one smart city. that you probably have heard about. And there are others. There are some that have been developed, I think, in Cambridge, England, certain other areas. But the populace that has experienced some of these efforts have not been terribly happy with what's happened. You want to be able to move around as you will. In some smart cities, you have to, I guess, report where you're going, and you're given a certain limited number of miles you can travel or situations where you can leave the city, but then you have to return. You can only go so many times, certain distances from the city. It's a matter of control, and it's not certainly within the realm of human liberty.
Yeah, and I think that these are coming. I've actually read quite a bit about them, and this is coming, and it's going to be a slow thing. It'll pop up in places like Sao Paulo, as you suggest, and I believe it's really starting to spread in Australia. But these are coming, and this is absolute tyranny. And as we said before, to where people in cities almost don't know that they're captive or that they're a slave. And in a large degree, all of us kind of are like that. We're all under the tyranny of Babylon still, but we try and enjoy what freedoms we do have, but they're just going to limit our freedoms more and more and more the further down the road we get here.
Yes, and I think it pays for us to, in that light, realize that it's if we can move outside the confines of an urban area, it's better for us. If you can do it, not everybody can, but it's very good to be aware of what's happening around us and to avoid the pitfalls of just being confined. The human spirit really craves for liberty. I will say that unequivocally, because I think that even though people may be restrained in a city and have lived all their lives in the city, if they're exposed to a natural environment, a room around them in a rural area, they will certainly prefer that. And but a lot of people are habituated to the city life, and that's just the way they believe things should be.
Yeah, and it occurs to me that a lot of people, the reason that they don't go towards God and the Bible is because they don't want to be told what to do. You know, they don't like all the rules and regulations. They want their freedom. But yet, the cities, and especially these smart cities, take away nearly every freedom. And these smart cities sound more like a giant prison to me.
Well, you pointed to the correct term there. That's what they are. They are prisons, and they're prisons after Satan's design. And they're the ultimate, you might say, in how the adversary is trying to suppress the natural God-given human rights, you might say, as are enshrined in our Constitution, or I should say our Declaration of Independence in particular. That is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or the pursuit of property. And that's the opposite of you'll owe nothing and be happy, as the
yeah.
as the World Economic Forum pronounces. So, yes, we need to be aware of what's happening and guard our minds, you know, from falling into these traps.
Yeah, Satan is a master marketer. Isn't he? I mean, they sell these smart cities and just in general life in the cities and the ways of Satan, really, as a utopia, as a way to move towards utopia where you'll have everything you need and everything you want is right here and we've got it all and everything's at your fingertips. And it's just a brilliant marketing strategy, but it's a lie.
Right. And it's really part of this transhumanist philosophy that's being promoted by certain organizations and individuals. And that is that, first of all, the assumption is that man is not really ideal, that he needs to be changed and he needs to be merged with the machine, or the computer being a machine, and ultimately be transformed. I was just reading today, too, that there are thoughts that, well, we can get immortality through the machine. You can be, I forget the name of the word that is designed to replace human beings, but then his memory can be put in digital form to transcend even life. When he dies, he's got the memory of who he was, and that's the vision of what some of these people are thinking.
With knowledge, you can be like God. Sounds familiar. I was wondering, Paul, I did read in your paper, and I'm familiar with the experiment, but would you mind sharing with the listeners what was found with the mouse utopia experiment?
Yeah, this is a most interesting study that was done. I'll go through it because I think it's really worthwhile to understand that this might have application to human beings. And that's really what these experiments set out to do in the beginning. The fellow by the name of John Calhoun from did some work at what's called the Rodent Ecology Project in Baltimore. This is back in the mid-1940s. He was a zoologist, professional zoologist, and he was working in a project that was trying to find ways to eliminate rodent pests in cities. Well, they abandoned that project because they couldn't figure out, you know, what aspect of rodent behavior to zero in on. But so he decided to go out on his own and do some experiments, and he designed several of them. But there was one in particular that really stood out of these many experiments, and it was called Universe 25. This is one he began in July of 1968. And get this now, he started out with 8 albino mice. These 8 mice were put in a cube that was 4.5 feet on the side. Not a very big area, but these 8 mice started there and started reproducing, of course. They had everything they needed. They had food, they had water, they had adjusted climate, so it was ideal for them. They had 256 compartments that were each accessible by tubes within the confines of this cube. There weren't any
everything within a 15-minute walk.
Yes, for a mouse, I'm not sure if that would apply.
Yeah.
There weren't any predators, no diseases, and you'd think that because of that, they would live to an extraordinary age, would you not?
Yeah, well, you could think.
Yeah, well, there was an initial adjustment period, and then the first pups were born 3.5 months later after they started. And the population doubled every 55 days after that. Over time, their growth rate slowed some, but get this, at the end of 19 months, they had 2,200 mice in that cube. 2,200 mice. But now you think, well, that sounds great. Maybe they would just maintain that population and things would continue on forever. But they did not. Things did not continue on as you might think. From that point on, it became, as the authors say, a mouse hell, if I might use that word. You know, there were no predators, no disease, no cold that would cull out some of the mice. So eventually what happened then was that they were in a condition where they didn't have room for expansion anymore, and the males that had their harems, you might say, were attacked by other males that were not able to find harems. So you had this competition of the male, and the finally the males would become the what they call the alpha males, or the the males that had litters, they would become exhausted, and then other males would invade their quarters, and then the females would try and fight them off, and finally they would get stressed and just abandon their nests and their pups. So even some of the mothers attacked their own young. So, and then over time, there was deviant behavior that appeared. Some of the mice kicked out their little pups early, and then the mice, which are very social type animals, they failed to develop healthy social bonds. So they struggled with this social interactions with other mice, and many of them then became hermits. They couldn't get along with their peers, so they would go, you know, into a corner or some empty compartment. But what was really interesting was that the males took to grooming themselves all day. They would preen and lick themselves hour after hour. And Calhoun had a special name for these male misfits. They're called the beautiful ones. And they had absolutely no interest in sex or in courting males or females. And there just was deviance amongst both males and females that was passed on to their progeny, which were becoming fewer and fewer. And finally, there just was no reproduction at all. And the infant mortality was almost total. So after not quite 5 years, the population had dropped to zero. There were none left. Of the 2,200 that had at the peak, there were none left. So the idea here was that this could apply to human populations. If you have a city that's populated heavily, that perhaps in time you might have a similar type of situation where, as we see now too, many families, many women don't want to have children. They've lost interest in reproduction. So as some have claimed that this universe 25 points towards the dangers of a socialist welfare state. And what do we have emerging all around us here in the world, even in this country? It's a move in that direction. So there are different ways that specialists and have interpreted this information on this Universe 25, but it's very startling what could be the ramifications of it. So I think it's worth noting that cities have problems, and this rodent study points to many of them.
Yeah, it sure does. I had forgotten that the population dropped to zero. I'd remembered a lot of the experiment. It also sounds familiar to me in the certain males, the alpha males, had all the women. And that sounds familiar too, because I don't know if you're familiar, but since the advent of social media, that has become a terrible, terrible problem, to where only the top 10% of men, as far as, you know, looks and finance and all those things, are really able to meet girls anymore. And there are a lot of young men that are having a terrible, terrible hard time even meeting women, or let alone getting married and having children. So that definitely sounds reminiscent of what we're experiencing in our day and age as well. That was a really interesting part of your paper, and I appreciate you sharing that with the listeners. I think we're kind of getting stretched in time here, so how about we round out the conversation talking a little bit about Jerusalem? I said we'd come back to it, and I wanted to do that. I have become concerned about our community, the Sabbatarian community, that it seems that a lot of people within the community really look to Israel and Jerusalem for guidance, for instruction, and have almost fallen in a trap, in my opinion, that the Jews or the Israelites are God's chosen people. It is my opinion that God's chosen people are those who choose the Messiah, that are now the spiritual Israel through the Messiah, and that it is no longer about the seed of Abraham. Would you agree, or what are your thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, that's a complex topic that I could not thoroughly discuss in the time we have left. And even if we had an hour or two or three, I probably would have trouble. But the scriptures do say that all Israel will be saved. So God, and that's speaking about national Israel, it's not, or genetic Israel, it's not speaking just about, you know, those that are have God's spirit, as you know, as we say, you know, those that are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise, who are, you know, from the Jewish or Gentile derivation. But I think it's important that we understand that certainly it is those in which God's spirit dwells that are the ones that are going to be, you know, raised. Those are the first fruits. But those, another issue that comes up, and I'm not addressing all of these issues thoroughly here, but the people in Israel are, for the most part, also not of the seed of Jacob. I think that's important to understand, and I could get into that in much detail as well. So I think that there's a great amount of misunderstanding as to how we ought to understand the Israeli situation today. I think we ought to look at all humankind as being potential sons of God, and God, whomever God calls, they are his people, and they can be from any derivation, any nation, any creed, and they can turn to him and become one of his people. But yes, we have to look at that aspect of our salvation first, and not at physical things. But God does say that Israel will be saved, and that's the descendants of Jacob. So I think that it's important to understand that, and realize that, well, where are Israel's descendants? I personally believe that a lot of them are right here in the United States, and of the 10 tribes that have been lost. And there's a series of books put up by Stephen Collins, who happens to be right here in the Sioux Falls, South Dakota area. He's written 5 books on this subject, and tracing Israel through Europe, the British Isles, Scandinavia, here to America and other Anglo-Saxon nations. So it's a big topic, and one that I would hope that everybody would do some serious study about in Scripture and in other sources.
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to get at would be is that all the nations of the earth will be blessed through the seed of Abraham, and that, of course, that would include Abraham's seed, the descendants of Abraham. It would include them because they are a part of all the nations of the earth. So certainly they would be inclusive to that. I wasn't meaning to suggest that they would be excluded. But I would also offer that I see in our community a lot of looking to Judaism, the practice of Judaism, as a way to learn more, to become more in tune with God's ways, etc. And that it concerns me because I think our Messiah has stated that God would put his laws on our heart, and that it is through his Holy Spirit that makes all of the things possible, that helps us overcome our evil nature, and it's not going to be through learning about rituals or worship techniques or anything like that. Am I making sense here?
You absolutely are. And I could concur with you in that very concern that you have, because really modern Judaism is a descendant of the Pharisees. Phariseeism and their beliefs, you know, and they had their set of laws and rules. As we know, when Jesus Christ confronted them, he would castigate them royally, such as in Matthew 23, called them whited walls and all sorts of things. But those rituals had nothing to do with the salvation that Jesus Christ offered through his blood. They were, in fact, deterrents. They were blockages for people to try and find that way. And certainly the parallel between the Pharisees and modern Judaism are very clear in my mind, and certainly we need to be aware of them. I personally believe that we'd be wise to be very wary of those rituals or those ways that might lead us away from the simplicity that's in Christ and the pathway that he wants us to follow. It's a narrow pathway. It's a difficult one, but it's possible to tread if we're careful to avoid the pitfalls, and this is one of them.
Yeah, and that's the new Jerusalem, right? We don't want to be looking at the Jerusalem of today. We want to look toward that new Jerusalem, God's city, where God is the king, where Messiah is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I'm reminded of Revelation, where it describes Jerusalem as Sodom and Egypt. And I believe that's a prophecy of what the Jerusalem of this world will become or has become in the end days. And that is not what we are supposed to be looking towards. We're supposed to be looking towards the new city, the new Jerusalem. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. The Jerusalem of today is just part of the cities of the world. It's a city that's, of course, got a tremendously rich history, and we can appreciate that. But it's not the city that we're to be looking towards as far as, you know, our futures and fulfilling the plan that God has for us through his Spirit. It is not. You might say Jerusalem in many ways is like any city, like Paris or Berlin or Chicago in many ways. Maybe not quite as bad as some of these, but it's still a part of the city system of this world. And it's firmly within the grasp of the adversary, and it needs to be changed. The city of the future will be the new Jerusalem, and that is going to be flawless. That is going to be pure, but we're not there yet. We're getting closer every day, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, and God's Spirit, in my opinion, is not in Jerusalem anymore. He removed his Spirit from there, and his Spirit is now in the new Jerusalem, and that's why I feel like we need to be looking towards that city. That's the only city we need to focus on. Anyway, that's just my opinion. I don't know how you come down on that, but we should round out our conversation here. Any parting words you want to offer, Paul?
Well, there's a lot that could be said. I appreciate being able to discuss this issue with you because it's such an important one. I would just like to recommend to anyone who hears this to consider the possibility, if you live in a city, of moving to the countryside, if you can do it. Especially that'll be important in these next days and months and years, because it's not going to get easier living within the confines of a city. It's going to be becoming more and more difficult, especially if there's a crisis, say the electricity turns off, and that will happen sometime to one degree or another in all cities. And when that happens, you won't want to be there. you need to consider getting in touch with someone perhaps outside the city who can help in a condition like that, someone that you can rely upon for help. Certainly amongst God's people, I think a community of people living outside the city would be a real fine goal for people to consider. Right here where we are in eastern South Dakota, we're in a rural area, and certainly we would invite anyone during times of crisis to be here. We have room, but not everybody knows of someone like we have here. We're pretty much self-sufficient. We've taken seriously the idea that, you know, you ought to be able to provide for your neighbors, and so therefore we have food in storage that can be used in times of crisis. We have in this part of the world, it gets cold in the winter, so we have a backup heating system. We have water. We dug a well on our property so we can pump water by hand. So these are things that can be done, and just we need to be aware of the times we live in and not take them lightly.
Yes, well said. And it doesn't take a whole lot of land to grow a lot of food. I saw a guy on YouTube, of all places, but he only had, I think, a half an acre of land, and this guy was growing more food than 10 families could eat. It was an amazing thing, and he saved his own seeds. And now, of course, you would need more land than that if you wanted to have livestock, but just as far as vegetable gardening, boy, you can grow a lot of food in a small amount of area.
Yes, there's a book called 5 Acres and Independence. It's written many years ago. I have a copy of it. And you're right, it doesn't take a lot of land. You just have to know how to raise food crops and preserve them for the off season. But it can be done, and it's not only a good idea, but it's fun. I mean, it's enjoyable. And you're close to nature. Gardening itself, you know, is good for your body in terms of exercise, sunlight, fresh air. Usually you're working with someone else, maybe your wife, like I work with my wife out there, and you solve problems as you're working in the garden, and it's just a wonderful experience.
It sure is. I'm reminded, my mom oftentimes will say, well, what are you going to do today? And I'll say back, whatever needs done. I mean, there's something that's got to be done around the homestead today, and I'm going to figure out what it is, and I'm going to go and do it.
Very good.
All right. Well, Paul, very much appreciate your time and sharing your thoughts with the audience. And maybe we'll get back together someday soon and do another couple of podcasts. What do you think?
I'd be most pleased if we could do that. Thank you for the offer.
Absolutely. Go ahead and hang on the line. I'm going to go ahead and sign off to the listeners. We appreciate you listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.